This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The true revolutionary force in Haiti is the leadership of the mass sectors, the peasantry, the workers, the ghettos, the women's sectors, and the unification of these different sectors, but they're always under the gun.
Professor Danny Shaw, who speaks fluent Haitian Creole and returned from his last trip to Haiti 1 month ago, speaks to Pacifica's Ann Garrison.
We are all going to be impacted in one way or another by austerity and the corporatization of whether it's, you know, ships, rail, flight.
America's infrastructure continues to decline, as evidenced by the East Palestine train wreck and the Baltimore Key Bridge shipwreck.
We have a lot of decentralized conflicts with unemployed workers because they're cutting off food to the soup kitchens. They're having layoffs. Wages are being destroyed. And we don't have a general strike.
Argentinian workers confront massive privatization, layoffs, and attacks on democratic rights.
The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
April 4th marks the 55th anniversary of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. With recent attacks on Black history and book banning in the U.S., scholar and activist Dr. Mtangulizi Sanyika says we must remember Reverend King's legacy. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Professor Danny Shaw spoke to Pacifica's Ann Garrison about the situation in Haiti. Shaw speaks fluent Haitian Creole and returned from his last trip to Haiti just a month ago.
Danny Shaw, what are the most salient points that you would make to anyone who's been hearing that Haiti is in the news again, but doesn't have a lot of background?
How tragic, how racist that Haiti is only in the news when it has to do with a coup or an epidemic or the next occupation or the assassination of quote unquote president or dictator. And what we saw 2 weeks ago, Haiti was the most trending story in the world on the front pages. I even received calls from India about Haiti, which is quite rare. And it was because one of the main paramilitary gang bosses, Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, there were these horrific white supremacist rumors that he was a cannibal who had eaten one of his victims. Any attack like that on any Haitian is an attack on all Haitians and their self-image and their self-esteem. The war on Haiti is an informational war, and it's a media war. So I think it's important to move beyond those headlines. There is indeed a crisis, but it's not a crisis that was just made in Haiti. We have to understand the colonial context that Mole Gaf, one of the key grassroots popular movements in the ghettos of Port-au-Prince, lays out. And again, the masses are trying to organize their own transition out of this crisis, a popular transition. Mole Gaf and the Black Alliance for Peace have a press conference this week. But what the United States is doing,
Is Mole Gaf the name of the popular movement?
Yeah. So Mole Gaf stands for the Movement for Equality and Liberation of All Haitians. It's one of the grassroots actors who organizes popular education and resistance, just as well as the Famille Lavalas. There's a peasant organization everybody should check out. It's called Keep Our Heads Together Peasant Movement. It's tough to translate the word, so I'll say it in Creole. Tête collée ti paysan. But hashtag Mole Gaf, MOLEGHAF. The United States is overseeing a quote-unquote transitionary government. They've said that Ariel Henry will also have some say in appointing this 7-person transitional council. I think they've gone back and forth about Henry's role. Anthony Blinken oversaw a meeting last week of the CARICOM leaders, namely President Ali of Guyana, the Jamaican president. These are imperial stooges. In order to even be considered for this 7-person transitional government, they had to agree to the pending U.S.-sponsored and directed a fourth invasion and occupation of Haiti in the past 100 years. And there's a lot of rumors as well that they would have to agree to overthrow the 1987 People's Constitution, which the Haitian people put into place based on the Déchoucage, a massive uprising of the masses, because the Constitution of the 1804 Revolution had been overthrown in 1915 when U.S. Marines occupied Haiti, reintroduced the corvée system, which was a system akin to slavery. And the main stipulation in that constitution that the U.S. re-implemented was that foreigners could own land in Haiti, whereas the 1804 Constitution said absolutely not. No foreigner would ever return to Haiti as a slave owner or as an exploiter. And that is the essence of that leadership of Toussaint Louverture, of Capois-Lamour, of La Martinière. There's so many different Haitian leaders. So that's where we're at today. The paramilitary gangs supposedly signed a truce about 10 days ago. The violence continues. Kempes Sonon, one of the most vicious warlords, again attacked Fort National. That is one of Malegaf's base neighborhoods. So Haitians continue to be slaughtered. A few days ago, we heard about a massacre by Izo, another gang boss, of the population in Pétionville. There's half a million Haitians, close to half a million Haitians, who have now been displaced by these death squads. The mainstream media says gangs. Gangs are not sociologically sufficient to understand this phenomenon. These are paramilitaries armed to the teeth. The U.S. and the Haitian ruling class have a history of using paramilitaries. From the time of the Tonton Macoutes to the 2004 coup under Guy Philippe, they've again reactivated their agent, Guy Philippe. Unless the State Department and the CIA are different than the mafia, my understanding is that, you know, once you're a State Department asset, you're always a State Department asset. So Guy Philippe, 20 years to the day after the successful coup against Aristide in 2004, Guy Philippe is back playing a berserker type role. And it seems as though the U.S. understands that the more chaos they can engender, the more of a justification they have for carrying out their fourth invasion and occupation.
What role would you say the drug traffic from Latin America to North America and Western Europe is playing in this?
It's extremely difficult for an investigative journalist or an ethnographer like myself to put together all of the dots, but it's very clear that in the south of Haiti, there are massive shipments, cocaine, marijuana, coming into the south, coming into these ports. The ports are controlled by the billionaire family of Biggio and the multimillionaire families of the Mevs and the Brands and the Charles Bakers and the Epeds. They control as well landing strips in small private airports. No guns, no drugs are produced on the island. When we talk about the island of Haiti, in the Dominican Republic as well, there's not a culture in the Dominican Republic of consuming these drugs, and they're not produced there. So it's a transshipment point because of this intentionally failed state. The mercenary bosses, the leaders of the death squads, the warlords, they're the ones that control the central arteries of Haiti, the central roads that connect Port-au-Prince to the south. So every exit out of Port-au-Prince, that's why we can say Port-au-Prince is like Gaza or the West Bank, perhaps more accurately, given we're talking about a complete elimination of a people in Gaza. Actually, I found out yesterday I'm going to be fired from my job after 20 years of teaching at John Jay College of Criminal Justice because of my quote-unquote language around Israel. That's the reason that they gave. But back to the Palestine of the Caribbean, it's highly profitable for these gang bosses to control these, what we would call highways. And that's how we begin to explain why these Haitian gangs or the paramilitaries who carry out the dirty work, Haitians always say that this is a désordre organisé et planifié, that this is planned and organized disaster, because it's inexplicable that in a country where the vast majority of people try to survive on less than $2 or $1 US dollar per day, that there would be these youth who often have balaclavas or ski masks. You've seen the images in the mainstream media, that they would be gripping weapons that range in price on the streets of Port-au-Prince from $10,000 to $30,000. And the only way we can begin to explain why a gang boss like a Barbecue or a Vital Homme or the Katsan Mawuzo in Croix des Bouquets, how could they have guns, such massive arsenals? Well, it's because the drug trade has been in there. And the drugs are then exported from the north of Haiti, ports of Port-de-Paix, the ports of Ocap. And then they make their way to the European market, to the U.S. market, where these drugs are consumed. In Haiti, besides perhaps the families and social milieu of the 0.01%, nobody could ever afford cocaine. And it's not part of Haitian culture. There's a history of drug dealing among the kleptocrats and the ruling class and the generals under Duvalier, under the U.S. appointed general, Namfi, after the first coup against Aristide, or I think it was actually before the coup of before the actual democratic election where Aristide won. So this is nothing new, and it's followed a similar pattern to what I just laid out.
I think that you have said that there was only one boat in the Haitian Coast Guard.
Yeah.
One boat. Okay, so it's not likely that it has any impact in limiting either the drug traffic or the arms traffic.
I wrote a piece for the North American Congress on Latin America, and I wrote that Haiti is a smuggler's paradise. Every day there's less police. On average, every month, these paramilitaries are killing dozens and dozens of police. And I'm not defending the Haitian police as an institution, because the Haitian National Police shot on unarmed demonstrations throughout 2021. They're extremely abusive. So when Canada and the U.S. have said that the HNP are the solution, that's extremely contradictory as well. But the one functioning Coast Guard boat gives a sense of how this is open season for international traffickers. Guy Philippe did a whole bit in a Florida jail for being a drug trafficker and a money launderer, and now he is attempting to be the next president of Haiti.
Some say that the coalition of paramilitary groups led by Jimmy Charitier, aka Barbecue, is revolutionary. What's your response to that?
I think it would be a grave mistake to oversimplify a complex historical and sociological phenomenon. Anyone who tells you Barbecue is the savior of Haiti, I would say that's absolutely ridiculous. That's based on how many different conversations across the ghettos of Port-au-Prince and in the north in Ocap and in the south in Jacmel and Okai. There hasn't been a census conducted in Haiti since the Aristide years, but there's an estimated 12 million, 13 million Haitians, and you'll probably have 13 million different points of view on Barbecue. And what I hear from the Haitian people all the time is, if he's truly a revolutionary, how come all the blood on his hands is of the malheureux, of the poor, of the dispossessed? Show us the pudding. Talk is cheap. When are you going to walk the walk? If you really have a war on the oligarchs, on this putrid system, how are you going to carry that out? Are you going to march on Pétionville? So a lot of people think it's all talk. Some people just see him as a media phenomenon. There's been an incredible amount of intrigue around him. What you hear a lot, and what I heard in 2021, as I marched shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of thousands of Haitians in the streets, the overwhelming sentiment was that Barbecue was one of Jovenel Moïse's, the dictator at the time, one of his enforcers, and that he would not allow anybody from the Delma Amba neighborhood, this ghetto in downtown Port-au-Prince, to participate in this massive insurrection, this massive popular insurrection. Some say that Barbecue's name is because when he was a little boy, there were so many Jimmies in Delma that he was distinguished from the other Jimmies because his mother sold barbecue chicken at night, so they called him Jimmy Barbecue. Others say that his nickname comes from all of the families in Bel Air and in La Saline and in Grand Ravine who he has burned to the ground. I think it would be a grave mistake for anyone to put all of their eggs in the Jimmy Chérizière basket. He's completely unproven. He's never been connected to any type of actual organized resistance across Haiti. So time will tell. It's way too early to cast any type of final judgment. Certainly the Haitian people are looking for a hero. So I think it would be easy to, you know, sneak in there, parachute in and create this whole narrative. And of course, for foreigners, you know, for foreigners, it would be so exciting to think that this Haitian Che Guevara. But the majority of the Haitian people are not buying that. But certainly where Jimmy Chérizière is from in Lower Delma, he is the man. The man, what type of man? What type of leader? Certainly he's the one with the power.
Where is the real liberatory force in Haiti, and how could it be actualized?
Indubitably, Jimmy Chérizière is a leader, but what type of leader? No question he's charismatic. To be able to somehow bring together all of these different gangsters, some of whom are just 100% criminal, cutthroat butchers and rapists, is no small feat. But what is he going to do with this Vivre Ensemble alliance? And after how many years of butchery, of blood, of invasions, and burning down entire communities, Jimmy Chérizière, about 2 weeks ago, has a press conference. He announces Vivre Ensemble. He announces that all these different paramilitary death squads are uniting. And he says to the Haitian people, pardon, you have to excuse us. You have to forgive us for what we've done. You're talking about upwards towards 500,000 refugees, internally displaced people, just in Port-au-Prince. You're talking about all of Bel Air and Kafoufé destroyed and burned to the ground. The true revolutionary force in Haiti is the leadership of the mass sectors, the peasantry, the workers, the ghettos, the women's sectors, and the unification of these different sectors. But they're always under the gun. It's been said by so many that Jimmy Chérizière and these other gang leaders are the Tonton Macoutes of today. We should continue to weigh all of the ethnographic evidence, and we should provide platforms for different Haitians and translate their voices, like the press conference we have with Malegaf. I think that's the most important role that we can play so that people feel hope and a sense of revolutionary optimism that the Haitian people will be the protagonist to usher in a new day with a true sense of economic, political, cultural, and diplomatic self-determination for the Haitian people.
That was Professor Danny Shaw, who has taught Latin American and Caribbean studies for nearly two decades at the City University of New York and the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Shortly before this interview was recorded, the John Jay College of Criminal Justice fired him because he had spoken openly about organizing against the genocide in Gaza.
Organisation mondiale yo pa pour nous yo ye. Ça la pour y dévoler yo piller dévorer. Les peuples qui l'ont dit prennent fusil, yo connaissent yo bouquet. La médecine internationale, ça met col sous côté. Yo fait réunion, yo parle, yo rancé. Devant vers champagne, bon divin, qu'importe, c'est là s'arrêter. Les peuples en bas, âme, tout pays, tout côté. Moi, je m'étends des autres cap analyser, l'aile pas concernée. L'aile pas concernée.
That was Organisation Mondiale by Mano Charlemagne. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. The shipwreck that brought down the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore came days after a conference in East Palestine about the catastrophic Norfolk Southern train derailment. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with activist and Towson University anthropology professor Nicole Fabricant, who is also with the South Baltimore Community Land Trust, about the state of American infrastructure.
So, Nicole, you were recently at a conference in East Palestine for the residents of the toxic vinyl chloride. They were contaminated. And then you came back to Baltimore, and lo and behold, there's a wreck there. In which immigrant workers are killed, and you have the same concerns that you have in Baltimore with East Palestine. Why don't you talk about those connections and the whole systemic problem working people are facing in this country, poor people?
Sure. Yeah, we had come out of East Palestine. We didn't get back till about 2 a.m. And then right the next day, Sunday morning early, I think around 1 o'clock or so, I started getting texts. Is everyone okay? So it was from one crisis to another. I have been thinking a lot about just the communities that bear the burden, essentially, of either extractive capitalism or profit-driven rail, which was so apparent in East Palestine, thinking about a community that wasn't really organizers before the derailment. Some of them were working all sorts of jobs. And then suddenly, with vinyl chloride being spilled and the burning of vinyl chloride, which created all sorts of new chemical compounds, their lives have been completely changed and altered. And in terms of Baltimore, there are lots of parallels here. One big one that I see is who bears the brunt of the burden of this shipwreck. It happened to be low-wage immigrant laborers who were subcontracted out. They were on the bridge. They were fixing potholes. So these are the guys at 1, 2, 3 in the morning that are fixing our potholes, very invisible in some respects, but the backbone of our economy, sending money home to parts of Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, and they don't receive any warning whatsoever. So it was my understanding that when the collapse or when the ship was about to crash into the Francis Scott Key Bridge, there were warnings to stop all the cars, right, from entering the bridge. However, the workers had no emergency contact. There was no sense, right, that this was even going to happen. So that's one area where I see connections to East Palestine. Lower middle class, working class peoples are the ones who actually are most impacted by these crises. The other is the lack of regulation on both, right? So with corporate rail, we see all sorts of squeezing of labor, cutbacks around questions of safety. Profit margins are exponential. However, workers are struggling daily to even get, you know, negotiate for sick days and more leave time. And then same, I've been reading constantly about maritime is kind of like a wild, wild west. It's sort of an unregulated business. And so when you think about that, and there were warning signs, because we know that the Dali, the ship, was flagged in June for having some major safety issues. So I think this question of the lack of regulation to protect workers or to protect communities is eventually going to impact all of us. We are all East Palestine. We are all going to be impacted in one way or another by austerity and the corporatization of whether it's, you know, ships, rail, flights, thinking about Boeing, right? There's so much that has come out recently about the catastrophes tied to kind of a neoliberal agenda, right? So.
And it seems that in the case of East Palestine, they still have no regulation protecting railroad workers and communities. It's in Congress. The residents are unable to get health care. They're running out of their health care. They can't move out of the town. Mm-hmm. They're locked in because they don't have money to move out, and they're being sold. They refuse to institute the Stafford Act so that they can get some health care and also compensation for their homes. And in the case of the railroad accidents, the Boeing, it seems like this systemic crisis and collapse of capitalism and the political bankruptcy of the Democrats and Republicans who are in charge, they seem to be okay with things continuing as is after one catastrophe after another, man-made catastrophes.
Absolutely. And our fears in Baltimore, which I'm sure East Palestine has been thinking about as well, is that in a kind of disaster capitalism framework, private sector will swoop in as a way to save the day. And so we're just talking to some colleagues and comrades yesterday about the fears of privatization of all sorts of public, what's left of the public good. So thinking about more corporatization and more private answers, which will only lead us further down these paths again, right?
And it seems that the companies that are responsible both for East Palestine wrecked, the Norfolk Southern, and the shipping companies are basically, as you say, it's unregulated. It's the wild, wild west. They do what they want, and they're not held accountable. And the CEOs, right, the billionaires who profit off this, they continue business as usual. So what does that say about what working people need to do. It seems that in both communities, East Palestine and Baltimore, face the same forces, political forces, mm-hmm. and control of the system.
Right, absolutely. So I think part of what we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years is also a decimation of labor and strong left kinds of unions. And so hopefully in this moment of crisis, we will see a revitalization. I came out of East Palestine feeling very hopeful about labor and environmental justice sort of aligning. For a long time, we've been trying to build these sort of relationships that don't naturally come together and are often pitted against one another. So usually in the area where I work in South Baltimore, there's 70 plus polluting industries. It's very easy for either politicians or the corporate sector to say these environmentalists are not working to your advantage. They're going to take jobs from you. And therefore, you might as well align with the corporate sort of whatever it might be entity, whether it's incineration, whether it's CSX and the rail lines. And so this has created enormous friction, right? And schisms in terms of movement building. But coming out of East Palestine, I really felt like this is the hope, because for a long time, unless we strengthen these movements, build mass allegiance across identity politics and sectors, right? We won't see much of a shift in this. It's pretty clear that at the federal level, right, bipartisan political contributions, lobbying just continues to plague our government. So there really are no checks and balances anymore. I always tell students it's very frustrating. Many of them want to get involved in government, but feel like, well, what's the point when it's completely bought out by fossil fuel industries, pharmaceuticals, agribusiness interests. So I think we need to get money out at the same time that we're sort of pressuring and building this movement. Really appreciate it.
So you have a campaign in Baltimore with railroad workers and environmentalists. Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. For 2 years, we've been fighting CSX, open air coal trains. They have been running lines through all sorts of low-income brown and black communities in Baltimore. They refuse to cover the trains, so it's open-air coal. They have the second largest export-oriented coal pier on the East Coast in a community that's overburdened by 70-plus industries. 2 years ago, they had rising levels of methane gas in their coal silo, and it exploded. Folks talked about the fact that the explosion felt like an earthquake. They were covered in coal dust from head to toe. The pier sits about 1,000 feet from a recreation center. So children are playing amidst coal dust. And it's been very hard to hold an $8 billion railroad company accountable. However, we've been building a very strong campaign with Railroad Workers United and many environmental justice organizations across the city of Baltimore to begin to think about depth. The very first step is that scientists from Johns Hopkins followed the lead of community residents that wanted data to prove how far the fugitive coal dust was traveling. They spent 8 to 10 months with a hyperlocal air monitor network, trail cameras documenting all the illegality and injustices tied to the coal pier. Had a really powerful report, which was released in December, and are pressuring really hard Maryland Department of the Environment to create much more stringent enforcement. So that's step one. Step two is really following in the path of Richmond, California. If we build enough power, if we build enough collective solidarity across interest groups, we think, like in Richmond, city council might pass an ordinance that would pressure for a just transition. So these rail companies would be forced to not carry the most toxic materials. So I see lots of intersect with East Palestine. And actually, that's why I traveled out weeks before with a group of movement organizers from Baltimore to build solidarity and say our struggles are united. We have to think across state bounds about these kinds of issues, because we're dealing with CSX and Norfolk Southern. You're dealing with vinyl chloride and Norfolk Southern. What would it look like to align? What would it look like to take on big rail as we begin to think about and push for nationalization of Railroad Workers United?
That was activist and anthropology professor Nicole Fabricant speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Out of chaos, confusion, bloody rains of recklessness, asylums of hatred and fear. From the cells of disillusion, crowded jails of hopelessness, prisons of the war profiteers. At the end of the road, the darkest hour, in the face of superior firepower, holding on the rain, riding on the winds of change, people gonna rise again. From desolation, rose and barren isolation holes, bottoms where the nobodies dwell. From the gutters and cracks and wrong side of the tracks, Sodoms and Gomorrahs of hell. Like a red sun blaze, a misty morning, a storm that falls without warning, a breath of fresh air.
That was music by Mike Stout. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. The election of Javier Milei as president of Argentina has led to massive privatizations, layoffs, attacks on democratic rights, and class confrontations. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke to Guillermo Kane, a deputy in the Buenos Aires provincial legislature, who represents the Workers' Left Front.
Milei is a political figure of very recent appearance in Argentina, of the last 5 years at most. He was a frequent television personality, commenting on economic and politics. He is a very far-right, so-called libertarian, but actually, you know, a very conservative, linked to political formations that have had relations with the Menem government in the 90s and the military dictatorship in the 70s, and promoting privatizations. He did a big campaign for dollarization and so on. In, for example, in 2022, which was a year of very meteoric rise of his media presence in the country, after he had presented himself for the first time to parliamentary elections in 2021, he was the economist with most airtime on the national TV channel. So he's definitely someone that sectors of the bourgeoisie have favored and have given a lot of air to try to channel a very big social and economic crisis in our country, and a very big political crisis of the traditional parties of the bourgeoisie, including Peronism, which, of course, has a leading role in unions, has a relationship with many social movements, has co-opted much of the traditional left in Argentina, and headed the last government with Alberto Fernández as president, which ended in a very severe economic disaster. So in a way, you could say that Peronism's fall, it was as much the central political event of the elections last year, and Milei was someone who was able to channel this in his favor, because he was not presented as having been part of any of the traditional parties that have been governing in the last 40 years, and which have led to a new debt crisis, very serious inflation and devaluation of the peso, and growing poverty. Around half of the population in Argentina is under the poverty line. Over 30% is under the extreme poverty line. So we're facing a very serious economic crisis. And Milei, who won around 30% of the direct vote in a very fragmented election, was able to win the ballotage or the runoff against Peronism, who had a very right-wing pro-IMF candidate called Sergio Massa, who basically campaigned saying he was the candidate who had the most direct line with Washington, D.C., with the IMF, to be able to handle the economic crisis. So they were also running on a very reactionary ticket, so to speak.
And initially, on coming to power, he and his security minister tried to prevent rallies and demonstrations. The Workers' Party and the left organized the first demonstration to challenge that. That was an important development, because there had been no physical mobilization against the government. What happened in that?
The PO, our organization, was very direct, saying that we did not need to wait for the blows to start coming from the government to rally against his open calls to devaluate salaries, to privatize, and to attack labor conquests and so on. And we called for an immediate demonstration, and this call was seconded by different working class organizations of unemployed workers, unions, human rights organizations, other parties of the left. And the day we chose was the December 20th, which was 10 days after he took office, and which was the anniversary of the popular rebellion in 2001, which ousted the La Rua government. So it's an important day here in Argentina. And this led to a very direct polemic between Milei, his security minister, Bullrich, who you were referring to, and their government, with the leaders of the PO, saying that they would not allow this demonstration, saying that it was illegal, even though, of course, demonstrating is a constitutional right in Argentina, the bourgeois constitution. Their constitution, not ours, but we're going to hold them up to it if this is the legal basis of the political regime in the country. So they did a very strong campaign to try to install fear, even with speakers in the railway stations, policemen on the trains. I don't know how to explain this. The federal state has apps on your phones where you have like your personal documentation. And there were things that said, if you are on welfare and you go to this march, we will take away welfare. So a very extreme process of trying to install fear. And still the demonstration was held. There were thousands of us. They put up police troopers, but we overcame the police troopers and we made it to the Plaza de Mayo and had a first rally. And that was the same day that he announced on TV his big decree, which changed 300 laws. And what happens when he finished the press conference that same day after our rally, announcing this decree, spontaneous demonstrations were held all over the country called cacerolazos, pot banging demonstrations that start in the houses of people and they start gathering on the streets. So on the same day, we held this march, which he tried to forbid. There were some comrades detained by the police. There were some clashes, but we held the rally anyway. He announced his big decree. And by that night, by midnight, there were thousands of people on the streets all over the country. This more spontaneous movement has led to a network of activists and neighbors and so on that have formed assemblies in many neighborhoods all over the country. So we could definitely say that this rally, where the PO and other sectors of the left were very quick to try to organize demonstrations against the government, it was like a first step, which also forced a few days later the Peronist-led unions to have to call some demonstrations, one partial national strike of 12 hours, and some limited actions. Though clearly the trade union bureaucracy is trying to limit the level of demonstration because the Peronist party has said openly that their line is to not confront Milei, but to let Milei govern. That labor reform is necessary, and that if people don't like the Milei government, they can vote them in the next election. But they are in no way calling to stand up against them. And the unions are very much acting very timidly, even though wages are being destroyed by the level of devaluation. We had 54% inflation in 2 months, in January and February, and wages have been under no conditions been able to get to that level. And there are being layoffs everywhere. For example, this week, it was very violent. We were having layoffs in the federal state on all levels, in all sort of organisms. And Milei said on Tuesday night, he said, there have been 50,000 layoffs in the state, and we will cancel contracts with different employees for 70,000 more positions in the next days to go. And on that same day, the center-left Peronist trade union of public employees, ATE, had said that they were canceling a strike to try to show good favor to get a negotiation going with Milei. He clearly is not interested in any negotiation, or at least a very profound conflict will have to be raised to force him to some level of negotiation. Now they're saying that next Wednesday this strike will be reconvened. But the situation is that yesterday we had clashes in public offices all over the country. because of these levels of layoffs that are happening. So we have a lot of decentralized conflicts with unemployed workers because they're cutting off food to the soup kitchens. They're throwing people out of their even very limited social welfare. We are having layoffs. Wages are being destroyed through devaluation and inflation. And we don't have a general strike, and we don't have a plan of action of the union. So what we are promoting from the PLO, and we're discussing with the left and with these popular assemblies, with combative and class struggle sectors in the union, with the Piquetero unemployed workers movement and so on, is the need for a national workers assembly, joining together rank and file delegates of union, of unemployed workers organization, popular assemblies, other sectors in struggle, to try to unify conflicts on a national scale, give it a common political platform against the government. And we'll see. As of yet, there have been many discussions among this. It has not yet been able to be organized. Wednesday, there was a meeting at the SUPNA, which is the National Tire Manufacturing Workers Union, which is headed by the PO. And we think maybe we will have a breakthrough this week. 1st of May, apart from being International Day of the Working Class, maybe we will be able to organize a National Workers Assembly to try to give a center to the ongoing demonstrations. We have had recently very massive demonstrations against the government on 8th of March, International Women's Day, for a government that has said it wants to make abortion illegal again, which is a very hard one, very recent hard one. Right by women in Argentina, very important movement. In the 24th of March, which, as I said, is the anniversary of the coup d'etat, a government that denies the genocide or justifies the genocide of the military dictatorship, saying it was a justified war against left-wing guerrilla organizations that they consider terrorist organizations, and saying it was a dirty war but a necessary one, and so on. And the 24th of March, there were hundreds of thousands of people in all the country. So there is definitely a strong opposition. But as I said, Peronism will not lead this opposition that is in the streets to victory. And we need to form a leadership with the left and all the sectors of the working class that are in struggle.
That was Guillermo Kane, a deputy in the Buenos Aires Provincial Parliament, representing the Workers' Left Front.
Una vez más verás las calles llenas de almas libres que no tienen dueño. Una vez más verás las calles llenas de aquellos a quienes les propuso un sueño. La patria llamando está. 12 campanadas es la hora de los pueblos. La llamando está. 12 campanadas, es hora de la lealtad, hora de luchar. Venga, somos los hijos de San Martín.
That was Daniel DeVita, La Hora de los Pueblos. Thursday, April 4th, marks the 55th anniversary of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's death. King had arrived in Memphis, Tennessee on April 3rd, 1968, to prepare for the Memphis Sanitation Workers' March the following day. Here's Akua Holt in conversation with scholar and activist Dr. Mtangolizi Sanyika.
Dr. M, thank you for being with us today. With the current hate speech we've seen toward African American history, culture, voting rights, and the removal of important books in schools throughout the South, what should we remember about Dr. King's legacy and its impact on our lives today?
Thank you very much for asking that question, Sister Akua. And it's a complex question, yet it's an easy question to answer. We always think of legacy when people leave us, but we also need to understand that Dr. King was building his legacy when he was still with us, and he himself left us some indication about what he wanted us to understand that his life was all about. In one of his sermons, he asked, what would he want said? And he said, just to tell him I tried to love somebody, tell him I tried to feed somebody, feed the hungry, tell him I tried to visit the sick and love those in prison. He basically was quoting the message of Jesus' first sermon. He was reiterating that message. Out of that message comes a number of particular ways that we can articulate King's legacy since he has now transitioned. And I just want to share a couple of those with our audience today. One of which is that his was a legacy of struggle. His life and his efforts and his protest and his opposition to segregation, as well as all other supremacists, taught us to struggle against unjust systems and practices. And that was a moral imperative, he said, to struggle against unjust systems, unjust practices, and unjust laws. And so King's life definitely inspired other social movements. It inspired, I think, the women's movement. I think it inspired the anti-war movement. It inspired the student movement. It inspired the ecology movement. He inspired us all to protest against injustice and unjust systems and practices anywhere in the world. And he said, I think that there was a moral imperative to do so. So he made it okay, if you would, for people to struggle against injustice. That was one. A second is, I think he taught us that part of his legacy was that institutional evil, institutional sins such as institutional racism and white supremacy are just as bad, if not worse, than the personal sin of prejudice behavior of individuals. There's the racism of individuals, and there's the racism of systems. And we oftentimes overlook the racism of systems. And he reminded us, after the Black Power movement especially, he reminded us there is a perception of a sin here. And I think he was influenced by a philosopher named Rauschenbusch, who was the primary writer about institutional sin and the social gospel, which the American concept of sin, in the American way it does Christianity anyway, skips over the sin of institutions and puts a lot of emphasis on the sin of individual behavior and talks about redemption for that behavior, but it doesn't focus on redemption of institutional behavior because it's institutions themselves that organize, benefit from, and operate the institutions of racism itself, especially white supremacy and white privilege. So I think King reminds us here about institutional sin as another legacy for all of us to remember that struggle is against institutions and not just trying to change the individual behavior. I think a third part of the legacy that he left to us was saying that, yes, and we must love one another, but he says love without justice is anemic. Love without justice is anemic. So when you hear King talk about love, it wasn't just this emotional love that we sometimes associate with love in the West, but it was a love coming out of the sense of what's called agape, the love of that the Creator unconditionally has for all of us. But justice is the equation that goes with that love. And if you don't have justice, i.e. if you aren't able to treat people and respect people's humanity and acknowledge them as human beings with all rights that are inherent, and if you have a system that doesn't recognize that, then your love, you're talking about a love that is irrelevant because the injustice is still in place. And so he says you have to link the sense of love with the sense of justice. Otherwise, it is anemic and it is relatively meaningless. He also tells us that justice belongs to all justice seekers. It doesn't just belong to any one group of us. It belongs to all thee who seek justice. Come unto me, if you would. In today's world, those who seek justice in the United States today are our friends. They are our allies. And we should learn to work together with all justice seekers because it is justice that indeed will prevail, especially when we can infuse it with love. That's another piece of the legacy that I think he left us that goes with the love, the demand for justice with love. And a fourth legacy, if you would, that he left us with is that poverty, racism, and extreme materialism are still the triple evils. He said that in one of his sermons. They're still triple evils today because they are still corrupting society today. Poverty, racism, extreme materialism, all the income inequalities, all the conspicuous consumption that we do, the excessive and unnecessary production and consumption that we do. And of course, the fact that we have all these income inequalities by race and by gender and by class, with a handful of people with most of the money at the top and everybody else in the middle and at the bottom struggling. There's a huge, massive wealth gap, for instance, between African Americans and white America, especially. And it may take another 100 years for that gap to close. If I last recall, it was a large gap. It wasn't a small gap. And to catch up would require massive, massive interventions that we have not had yet. The problem of poverty is there. It is structured into our institutions by the way income is produced and distributed. And that is something that we will have to continue to fight against. But we should not accept ever that poverty is a norm. And then finally, the other legacy that he left us is that war corrupts the human spirit. War corrupts the human spirit. We see that in Gaza right now. We see that the way the Israeli is conducting that war, the human spirit has been corrupted by Netanyahu and his war council. They have no regard for the humanity of the Palestinians. And so there's nothing for them to kill 31,000 Palestinians because 1,700 or so Israelis were killed. I mean, you can't equate human lives that way, but what he is doing is genocidal. War has corrupted the human spirit, and it is not a solution to human problems. And so those are some of the things that I think are the legacies that he left us. There are many other ways that anybody else could articulate that, but having known him myself personally and worked with him, that's one way, a couple of ways, I should say, that I see his legacy and always remember it as a guide to my own life, especially as it relates to love and justice and struggles against inequality and poverty and racism and all of that.
Thank you, Dr. Sanyika. Before we go, Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his last speech, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," on a stormy night, April 3rd, 1968, at the Bishop Charles Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. You mentioned this was a moment of clarity for Dr. King and that he knew something was about to happen.
I have been to the mountaintop. I have seen the promised land. One of the greatest pieces of oratory that you will ever find. When you look at that tape of that mountaintop speech, your heart just moves, your soul just rattles, and your mind just starts expanding about what you're looking at. You knew you were looking at something unique in this human being and where this human being was going with his journey. And what was to happen next, you knew would be something spectacular. And so I think that he was warning us and letting us know what was about to come. Indeed, it didn't take long after that. Within a day, he had become an ancestor. Many of us believe that the U.S. government may have had something to do with that. Many of us do not believe the story as the story is told presently about how and why he was assassinated. He had definitely become a problem for the state itself. Beyond just he had become a global leader and was challenging the things that his government was doing that he thought were incorrect and was challenging power and principality as he saw it in his own homeland, and was demanding that we move towards justice. And when he started to challenge America's imperialist behavior in Vietnam and the war, the dynamics of his relationships to the American political scene radically changed from just being a civil rights problem to being a global human problem at that point. And I think that's when the state may have made a decision that it was time for him to go.
You've just heard from retired scholar activist Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika. I'm Makua Holt.
Tell your parents that better stop and think, 'cause we're heading for the breakdown. Better believe it. What's gonna happen now that the king of love is dead? Will the murders ever cease? Are they men? Are they beasts? What do people, what do they think they have to gain? Will your nation stand or fall? Is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain?
That was Nina Simone, "Why the King of Love is Dead." And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Ann Garrison, Steve Seltzer, Akua Holt, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificusCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.